Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. I'm going to keep this quick. This is the, well, I don't know if this is the third episode, but in the series as we planned it, this is the third episode. We might have thrown some comedy festival episodes in between. I don't know. Not even sure why I brought it up. Anyway, you may be listening to these out of order. This may be the first episode you've ever listened to. This is possibly the worst introduction I've done, although you could go back over the last 52, 53 of them and decide that's probably not the case. The intros are always terrible. Here's who's on the show today, Joe Stanley. Joe Stanley is an amazing radio broadcaster. I've known Joe for over 20 years. We started out doing stand-up comedy in Melbourne together. We were friendly back then. We have not necessarily worked in the same places over the next 20 years. So we've only caught up occasionally, you know, when I pop into her radio show to, you know, do an interview and say hello. But I've always enjoyed Joe's company, but I've always really enjoyed her as a radio broadcaster. She found what she was absolutely brilliant at. She's the, I believe, the only woman ever in Melbourne to have two separate number one radio shows on different networks. I think she's probably an underrated talent despite that. She's one of Australian entertainment's quiet achievers. She's just been going about her job day by day, filling 3 hours of radio content effectively, professionally, with great intent and great commitment for, you know, over a decade, much longer than that. And that, in fact, it's an incredible achievement that she probably doesn't get quite enough credit for, I'd imagine. This was a really lovely chat. I haven't had an opportunity to sit down with Joe and ask her these questions and talk about these things ever in the time that we've known each other. So it's a great gift to be able to do that after 20 years of knowing somebody on the surface and enjoying them as a person and a broadcaster, to then sit down and get the opportunity to ask them what makes them tick. And I loved it. I loved the answers. I loved where she went with it. She believes a whole bunch of different things to what I believe, but I was fascinated to hear what they were and why she believed them and where those belief systems came from. You know, that's the idea of what we're doing here. So I think you're going to like this podcast. I hope you're going to enjoy it very much. A big thank you to Joe. Check out all her stuff, her writing. She's writing a book at the moment. I'm sure she'll be back on the radio soon. And if there's any radio programmers out there, then you better be quick, I reckon, because this is one of the rare talents in Australian broadcasting. And as soon as she finds another job, she'll probably do that for 5 years and take that show to number one as well. So I'm sure she won't be out of the game for long. She's so just naturally talented and brilliant at it. So this is Joe Stanley. I hope you're really going to enjoy it. I am, of course, still currently on tour. Will Legal is the name of my show. It's all about my arrest in Wagga Wagga. The entire show takes place between when I left home on the Saturday and I got home on the Sunday night. It's the first time I've done an entire show that is just one story. The entire thing is just one story. It's all self-contained. There's a little time travel in the middle, but it starts when I leave and it ends when I get home. And I've worked very hard on it. It's been a real process to turn it from my story into a story for audiences. And that has been something that has been very unique to what I've done in the past, and it's taught me a whole bunch of different lessons, and I think the show now is in great shape, so come out and see it. That's the easiest way to support this podcast. If you like the podcast, come and see a live show. Melbourne at the moment, then Perth, Canberra, Sydney, other dates to follow. All right, there you go. That's the intro. Enjoy this episode with Joe Stanley. Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. And joining me today, someone I'm very excited to have on the podcast because it's someone that I've known for quite a while, but I can't remember when, if ever, we've sat down and had a conversation like this. So I think that's going to be very exciting. It's so true. Firstly, guest, who are you?
I'm Joe Stanley. That's my name. Who am I, Will? I'm a deeply flawed work in progress.
Okay, I like that. That's a good start. I love it. I just like asking that question because everybody brings something different to the table when you ask them who they are.
What would you say? I mean, it's a hard question.
Yeah, I get the great prerogative of asking that question and not having to answer it. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. I've already done my bit.
Yeah.
So Joe Stanley is here, an amazing broadcaster, comedian, writer, columnist, all sorts of other things, a multimedia performer. This podcast, I like to ask people if they have a philosophy towards anything. And I, just from the way that you introduced yourself, I imagine that your philosophy might be related to the idea that you think about yourself as a flawed work in progress. So tell me what your philosophy is, and then I can see if I was right or wrong.
Okay. Well, I guess my philosophy is that we are here for a purpose, but I don't think that purpose reveals itself to you perhaps ever. Like, I feel like, you know, we just sort of are on our path. I believe that time unfolds as it needs to. So whenever weird things happen, you're like, whoa, that surprised me, like being sacked, you know, that sort of shit. And it's deeply painful. To me, that's great comfort that I know that, well, but time unfolds as it needs to and this path will reveal itself and I'm in the exact moment I need to be right now.
Okay, that's okay. So, firstly, fascinating. We've dived into the deep end, and I like it.
I've written a list of other philosophies I have that aren't nearly as deep. I'm a rule maker in my life.
Okay,
because I'm a very anxious person, so okay. I prefer to have rules so I don't have to think about.
So the rules are to deal with the anxiety. Is that what it is? It gives you
basically
a framework.
Yeah. So, but things. So I have much lighter philosophies that aren't as that. But we can go down the deep path or the funny.
No, I like the deep path. This is. I mean, essentially, what this whole podcast is about is like. I mean, essentially, what I really want to go to people is life. What is it? What do you reckon? Right, what's it all about?
Yeah. Well, I think life is this moment that we've been given. What a great gift it is.
Let's dig down in that a bit deeper. Maybe let's start with using a practical example that you brought up yourself to kind of explain the framework of it. That might be a good way to start.
Yep.
So you mentioned being sacked. That's quite recent. And obviously
this time round, it's happened three times. So, you know.
Okay. Well, how to deal with being sacked and through the prism of what you've just said, I think is an interesting thing to talk about. So you were doing a radio show with my friend Limo, who of course is going to be on this podcast as well. And it was the number one radio show in the market. And then a couple of weeks later, it was public that they weren't inviting you back to do the show again the next year. So a lot of the time people would associate the idea of being number one, of being successful at the job that you do, to be a sort of, I guess, a safety barrier for the fact that you were going to get sacked. But it's actually a really good example of the idea that sometimes even success in your job or accomplishment in your job doesn't stop bad things coming along regardless.
Exactly.
So I think it's an interesting place to start because of
because life is shit. Life is hard. It's painful. There's disappointments. There's fear. We're all frightened of something. We're all consumed with that anxiety of what if I don't achieve that goal? What if people don't like me? What if, you know, my lover leaves me? What if my kids get sick? Like, you've just got all that shit going on in your head, right? And you're right. We had a great show. We loved it. We were successful. People loved us. We loved them. Sorry, ba-bow. We're taking that away from you for whatever reason. Some people, like Limo, are still questioning and he's very angry still. I really, whatever, you move on. But at the time, it's devastating to me. I'm someone who is easily fall into the trap of assuming it's me and assuming there's something wrong with me. And also that evil poison in your brain of comparing yourself to other people. And so you kind of spiral for a bit, but then out of that, I always go to mindfulness and meditation. I meditate every day. And essentially what that teaches me is that instantly through my breath, I get back into this moment. And in this moment, I am happy. In this moment, the sun is shining. In this moment, there are sparks of joy and I don't need to allow whatever shit has just happened that deeply devastates me to actually sway me from the knowledge that this is the right place for me right now. And I don't know what will happen in 1, 3, 6 months, a year, who knows, but it will unfold that this is what's supposed to have happened for me.
It's interesting though, because in the moment that you find out about something like that, see, here's the thing. I've done things that have not worked before. And you're very aware that at some stage you're going to get a tap on the shoulder and say, thanks very much for your time, but it's time for you to go away now.
Yeah.
Right. But this wasn't that. This is a different thing. So I think that for people, you know, who are listening to this, we all understand the idea of like, you know, if a relationship has been going badly, you can see it coming to the end. But this is like, you know, you're fucking every day, like, you know, you're planning holidays together and then the next day they're just like, you're dumped, I'm leaving you.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and that's a great analogy. Like, I haven't I suppose I've not lost a relationship in that way. So there'll be people listening who go, yeah, thanks very much, you wise bitch. You're very annoying, because when I lost my partner, there was no goodness. Certainly when people are sick and they die, that's really, like, my father died when I was 4, and I look at my mother and I think, you know, I don't know how she would have ever found any joy in that time. But so I guess I haven't been tested, like properly tested. But for me, my experience has been that, I don't know, that I can't, if I rail against what is happening, that's going to make it harder.
How quickly can you process that? You know, from
not very quickly. Okay. No, not very quickly.
So what happens first? What happens before you get to the point where you start to go, I can rationalize this, I can be mindful about this, I can put this into my overall view of the world? What's the initial bit before that?
The initial bit is crying a lot. I don't sleep at all. Wandering through the house like I'm like Lady Macbeth, just churning. And drinking a lot and just crying a lot and just really being so knocked about in your self-esteem, you know, just feeling like I'm worthless, no one will give me a job. At the time, I had a really bad hair dye job. Not this one. It's recovered. But I had a hair's ass.
Your hair looks
good,
by the way.
Thanks.
This is an audio medium, but yeah, just for the listeners at home, your hair is on point.
Yeah, I had a hair disaster, so I bleached my hair, and the first few goes was great, but then it was a disaster, and it fell out. So then my hair's falling out at the same time. I think no one's going to ever hire me again because I'm bald. I'm hideous. All I can do is eat ice cream and drink a lot, and you know, so they're probably a month or two of that.
How
easily.
Much of your personal self-worth is linked to your work, do you think?
Not very much now, but I think all of us do that. All of us have that sense that, well, this is – I think it's a status thing, particularly – I don't know if we're particularly obsessed with it in Australia, but I had this thing for a while where I'm still sort of doing it, where, you know, people always ask, what do you do? And so I was experimenting with not asking that question when you first meet someone.
Right.
So I was having a bit of fun trying to ask other questions.
Yeah.
And
that's why this podcast starts with, who are you?
Exactly. But you can't ask someone that when you're just meeting them at a grand final barbecue or something.
You're going to be like, so who are you? Yeah. Barry. No. Who are you?
Exactly. So my sister brought her new partner to Christmas Day. And I, instead of asking him, what do you do? I said, so what are you into? And I think he thought I was asking in some weird
do you party?
Yeah. He's like, oh my God, this is awkward. I just met my girlfriend's sister. I don't know what she's inviting me to. So, yeah, I think we're obsessed with status here. And that's why we align who we are with what we do, our job. And that's a ridiculous thing to do.
You mentioned before that, you know, horrible temptation in our minds to compare ourselves to others. Mm. And I think you're right in what you say, that it is a completely destructive thing. Like the amount of times that I've had to say to somebody when they're bitching about someone getting a job, did you want that job? And they're like, no. And then you're like, well, why do you care one bit that somebody else got a job that you wouldn't even take if you were offered it yourself? But
is that,
it's
but
a natural
that,
human thing to do.
Do you think,
right?
That's because we're creative, that we're worse at that? Because there are so few jobs.
Oh, I don't think so. I think that probably in any industry, I reckon if you're a carpenter and some shitty carpenter gets the job instead of you, then you're still like, look at old fucking Jesus. He's not even doing his carpentry anymore. He mostly just walks around with his mates, like walking on water and talking to people.
I mean, he only got the job because he's brought all those fishes and loaves.
Exactly, mate. And his dad is a carpenter. It's a family business, mate.
Just because he's turning water into wine.
Does not matter. Exactly. Good for knockoff drinks on Thursday, Jesus. Great to have around. But are you a person who, do you see yourself as a competitive person, or is it something that just flashes in and out and that you kind of go, I don't like that about who I am?
No, but I'm not competitive. I just see myself as lesser.
Okay.
But so, and see, I look at you and I think, well, Will Anderson, and this is what's so funny to me, and this is the rational side of my brain whenever I start comparing myself to other people, right? I look at Will Anderson and I think, highly successful dude, very much in demand. There's no chance that's a guy who struggles for work or struggles for the kind of work that he wants. And I think, well, I'm not that person. I've never been that person. I'm not in demand. I'm not someone who gets amazing gigs all the time. And I suppose my natural inclination is to compare myself in a way that makes that paints me as a complete loser.
How many radio shows have you done that have been number one?
Two.
Yeah, right. I mean,
I'm told I'm the only woman in Melbourne to have done that. So.
Right. So, you know.
I still haven't got a job. I'm sitting here unemployed.
It's only been
unemployed.
It's only been 3 months, mate. You'll be fine. You'll be all right.
But you know what I mean? So then I think logically, though, if I'm someone who does that, then Will Anderson must do that too.
Oh, I think everybody does that, right? And also, we only ever see the successes of what people – you see when that person gets that job. You don't see the three things that they didn't get or the – you don't see the fact that I sent five auditions to the Daily Show when they were looking for new people, and Ronnie Cheng, who's a young comedian who I love, by the way, and very glad for his success, but he comes along and he suddenly is working on the Daily Show. Like, of course, you have all those things in your own life. People just sometimes don't see them.
No, exactly. It's Insta life, isn't it? You're just comparing yourself to this ludicrous Insta thing. I think, gorgeous Janelle Koenig, who is an amazing comic and one of my best friends, she, I think, quoted maybe Abraham Lincoln or someone like that. She said,
I'm sure Abraham Lincoln would be happy that it's Abraham Lincoln or some old guy. Definitely had a beard, I reckon.
That's what I'm like. I'm not very good at remembering facts. But the quote was, comparison is the death of joy. And it really is. It takes any kind of joy that you already have in your life away from you because you think that person has more joy. And it's not true. That person does not have more joy.
Unfortunately, what I believe to be true, and this is just certainly my personal perspective, but I think that what you're seeing is certainly reinforced by the nature of capitalism and advertising because...
I love that you just said the nature of capitalism.
Well, it is though.
It's the best statement ever.
Because capitalism doesn't want you to be happy. Mm. Because if you're happy with what you have, you don't need to buy any more shit. You don't have to get a bigger TV or you don't have to get a better car. The only reason that you have to do those things is because advertising is telling you that the guy next to you has a better car than you or a better house and those sort of things. And you shouldn't be happy with what you have because you should aspire to have this other thing. So we're raised on advertising from a very young age and it traps us in a cycle of always wanting more. So I think it's hard for us as human beings. We think it's our own inbuilt, you know, jealousies and insecurities, but often we've just been raised being manipulated by the world's greatest manipulators to never be happy with what we have.
It sends me insane. I live with a 9-year-old who children are the greatest capitalists you'll ever meet.
Right.
Because all they want is want. I want that. I want that. And you're like, why? They can't even tell you why. They just want it. And my husband, who's a hoarder, and he just shit appears in our house and I spend my life just throwing stuff out in the cover of darkness so that I don't have it in my house and people don't even notice it's gone. But I desperately desire to be a minimalist. You have a house with nothing and I love that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I must admit that there is...
I mean, it's extreme nothing.
There's a part of me that would like a little bit more stuff than what I have. Maybe the internet and a television. A fridge that isn't on the roof. Yeah, exactly. There's some things I'd like, but... But I agree with you. Like the idea of, so for us, we're not moving all our stuff in here. This is a fresh start of like, you know, for this house and buying new stuff. And one of the things that I don't want to do is buy anything that's unnecessary.
Yes.
I just like to have a house that is like all the stuff you need, but nothing more than what
nothing
you need.
Nothing more. I love the idea of that. I have a friend who's a true minimalist and they only, it's him and his partner, they have... two plates, a set of cutlery for each of them, a bowl each, and a cup each. That's it.
I mean,
they're not entertainers, obviously.
I was going to say, hard when you have people over. That's what I would say.
They clearly don't. But I'm very envious of that. And they don't ever have to, like, they don't use the dishwasher because they don't have to. They just wash it up when they
use it. It is something about that where you just go, well, I'll just wash the dishes that I have. I mean, you were mocking me before because I don't have a kettle yet.
Well, the kettle. I mean, I know. I see there's something very practical about using a pasta pot
right.
for that.
I mean, it's just, it's used for boiling water. It is essentially a giant kettle that just doesn't have a practical spout.
I mean, you imagine people coming from, you know, India and seeing us with all our different pots and thinking, why do you need so many different pots of different shapes and sizes?
You've got like three frying pans. How many different degrees of frying are you really doing?
Yeah. Exactly. You can't fry all of the frying pans at the same time. No. It's madness. Yeah.
The idea that there is some sort of path that we are on, which is this, you know, sort of idea that you started with. Let's kind of dig down a little deeper into that and what you actually mean by that. So you spoke about losing your father when you were very young, and I imagine that shapes a life very much. Mm. Like I imagine, I've been lucky enough that both my parents are still with us, but having had friends who've lost a parent young, you see that it has an effect on their life. Do you feel like that it has shaped your life in some way?
Yeah, I think so. And it's hard for me to reconcile the loss that my mother must have felt and how that really obviously had a horrific effect on her life. And, yeah, it's been a harder life for me, but at the same time I think I've benefited enormously from what I've learnt about compassion and strength, and it's made me someone who really understands loss in a way that I think is valuable as a human in relating to other people. Everybody has loss, and I kind of appreciate being able to understand that in other people. And a lot of the work I do with different organizations and charities that are with people that are deeply sad, you know, homeless people or women who've been in crisis. I've not had that experience because I'm very blessed, but I think that I'm able to offer something because of my experience of loss. And that to me, in a way, that's sort of part of what I think is my path. I don't know. I want to have a very uplifting impact on the world and the people that I engage with. And I think that's partly because of that upbringing that I had of there being just deep sadness in our house.
There's an empathy about your work that I think is probably one of its defining factors, to be honest. I never quite understood it until I saw it up close, how good you are at understanding a moment or understanding. We were in the radio studio one day, and this is not to in any way say that, you know, I hadn't thought that your work was great before, but I got a closer and greater understanding of what made it so good, I think, in this moment, where we were having a very fun chat about, comedy festival or something like that, you know, some nonsense.
Some
fluff. Yeah, exactly. Some fluff, having some fun. But there was a story that day, a tragedy in the news, and some children had been hurt in some way. I can't even remember how. It was probably a school shooting or something. You know, there's so many of them these days. But you managed to transition from quite a comic conversation to just saying something, you know, very empathetic about the nature of being a mother and, you know, in the context of a day like that. And I was very struck by how easily you did it, because it wasn't manipulative. Mm. It wasn't somebody going, I should reference this. It was just a sort of genuine, empathetic sort of thought. You know, that you said the thing that I didn't know was the right thing to say until I heard you say it,
if that makes sense.
Do you think that is a strength of yours? I mean, it's hard to ask, I know, you about that, but I've told my story now.
Yes.
Do you get that sense that you are empathetic to other people's stories?
What I have the sense of is that my emotions are on the surface, probably more than a lot of other people, and I know that because I have friends who, and including my husband and now my daughter as well, who roll their eyes when I start crying because like, oh, fuck, here she goes again. Because I really, it's just like I feel it's my, you know, the feels are really on the surface all the time. And if that's empathy, I guess that's what that is.
Yeah, I think it is.
And you know, I had a friend who's that classic understated, very dry gay man. we went for a walk through the, what's that, Hampstead Cemetery in London, which, you know, you're surrounded by dead people, and we happened across the section where the babies are buried,
right.
And I've just started bawling, and he's gone, oh, what is wrong with you now? And I'm like, well, children are buried here. I'm sorry, I feel things very deeply. And he said, I know, but must we hear about it all the time? And I'm like, well, I don't know, it spills out of me. I can't help it. And I see it and feel it in other people. And I guess I think that I just want people to know that I kind of get it.
Do you have a framework within which you protect yourself from that? Like, I mean, because it can't be a thing that you can do all the time, right? You can't wear your emotions like, you know, on Front Street at all times. It's just not a practical way to live your life. So is there kind of two different zones of you? Is there one where you're like, this is me, and so if I think something's hilarious, I can think it's hilarious. Yeah. If I think it makes me cry, then I'm happy to cry. Or is there another you that you can kind of go into that could put that person away, or is it always there?
But isn't that why we love comedy? Isn't that why
Me why you love comedy.
Well, I think you just laugh. You laugh through everything. I learned that from my grandmother and my nana and my mother. We were a family of women. We just laughed no matter what, told stories that were funny. And I think that's one of the greatest joys of comedy, that you can laugh even when you are surrounded by deep sadness. And I think that's why the philosophy around that this moment, if you're in this moment, sadness and happiness can coexist. Laughter can coexist with the deep, sad feels. And I guess that's where, you know, I'm not going to just burst into tears everywhere I go. Most of the time I'm going to be laughing at myself and what a maniac I am for crying all the time.
It's,
you know, that's, don't you think that's why we love comedy?
Well, I love that thought that the two things can exist at once. Because I think that often the mistake we make is we think that, like, you know, life is very binary, in that you are sad or that you are happy, or that you are angry, or you are, you know, whatever. Like,
and I'm not talking about mental illness. That's a very different thing. Depression and actual mental illness, that is different. And by all accounts, that's a blackness you can't ever see light in. I get that. But I'm talking about, oh, I'm having a sad day. Well, but at the same time, I just fell over in the middle of the street, and that's hilarious. Which, by the way, I did do the other night, and it was hilarious.
Oh, I'm a big faller over as well. I'm so unco. Like, and you know what? I also, for somebody who can't bend over very well, I drop things all the time.
Oh no! How annoying!
Like all the time. I'm so clumsy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're a grown up and when you trip like a kid and you're a grown up, that's as comical as it can get.
I mean, it really is one of those things where so I'm just doing this show at the moment about getting arrested, and one of, like, there's stories in it that didn't make the cut because you just can't quite make them work for the story.
Yes.
But one of the things that I ended up having to leave out of the show was, like, so I've got arrested. I've still got to try to make it to the show. I've got like 10 minutes to have a shower and I've got a bad back. And so I've had the shower, but the floor's slippery in the hotel. And so as I'm going to put on my shoes, I slip over and nearly break my back again. And I just thought, imagine if they found me after being arrested, like with my pants around my ankles, like on the floor. Like, but I'm unco. I just fall over all the time. It's terrible.
Maybe it's because you've got a bad back and your balance is weird.
Nah, I was unco before.
No, were you?
This hasn't helped.
I'm trying to be nice to you.
No,
I'm
appreciate
trying to
it.
Find a reason for things.
What framework do you, like, so if you say that, you know, we're on some sort of path, or that, you know, kind of a version of that, these things are not everything happens for a reason, because I think that's trite, but that, you know, life is about experiencing good things, bad things, tough things, challenging things. That's what being a human being is. And if you think it's going to be anything else than that, you're kind of fooling yourself.
Yes.
And then you have a choice to then go, well, this is life.
Yep.
What is happening right now? This sadness, the fact that I've had a setback professionally or personally, or I have an illness, or, you know, my child has an illness, or these are all the things of life.
Mm.
You would be ridiculous if you were thinking you were going to live life without these things happening.
Exactly.
So I will be in this moment and understand it to be the best way to deal with it, to be in the moment. Where did that line of thought come from? How did it develop in you? Has it been something that you've thought that way for a long time, or is that a recent sort of thing that you've come to?
No, I certainly wasn't. I don't think I was raised that way. I was raised in a Christian family, so it was sort of, I guess, the way I was raised was pray to God and it will be okay, I guess. So it's sort of a similar philosophy in a way.
Did any of that stick, the religious stuff?
Yeah, in as much as I do pray, I have a real sense. But then it's no different to meditation. It's kind of the same thing. And positive mantras. That's basically what prayer is, really. It's just you've given it a person or a being that you're praying to. I don't know. But the whole mindfulness and being in the present, I guess that started maybe 15 years ago. I read the book The Power of Now. And it just fucking blew my mind. This concept that there is no past and there is no future.
That there is only now.
There's only now. So all of those hurts from the past, which, oh my God, I'm a churner. I like to hold on to everything. It's like someone, if you came up to me and said, see that really sad thing you're holding on to? I'd be going, no, it's mine. I want that sad thing. I want that sad thing for ages to be really sad about. You know, it's craziness.
No, I don't think that's craziness. I think that's a very natural human instinct that you hold on to your hurt and you reframe it in your own way. But I also think that you use it to torture and prosecute yourself.
Yes.
I mean, we all have that voice in our head.
They say that, our survival instinct is to hold on to those things because that's how we learn not to run after that bear again.
Right.
You know. So that's why we do it. But our brains can't understand that there is no bear anymore. We kind of still fear that bear. It's right. Like, let go of the bear. Seriously. Bear's not going to hurt you anymore. It's just that's that amygdala, that part of our brain, that ancient part of the brain that just still has the cortisol and still has the stress and, you know. So there's that. But also the fear of what might happen in the future, which if you have anxiety, you stay awake at night just going, that wind, I can hear that wind. What if it knocks over the tree outside and my house, my roof caves in right through to in a year's time I have to go to that thing and I'm fucking terrified of it now and I won't sleep for a whole year thinking about that thing. Like this is partly why I don't do stand-up anymore. I just can't. I can't deal with the anxiety.
What part of stand-up made you anxious? Because, well, I mean, to me, okay, I'll give you some context.
Yeah.
To me, you seem like a very natural performer. When I first met you, you seemed like one of the people who was most comfortable on stage of anybody who was around our age. We were all, you know, there was a whole gang of us around the sort of same age doing shows together. And you always certainly came across, at least externally, as being a very comfortable performer. So was it the performance aspect? Was it the anticipation aspect? What aspect of it made you anxious?
I don't really remember, because back then I think I did like it.
Yeah. Well, also you can change, right?
That's the other thing. I just got old and fearful. Right.
And what's the fear?
People hating me, I guess. Aren't you frightened of that when you go on stage? Like your stage presence is so phenomenal and your confidence is so blinding that it's hard. Again, here we go, back to the comparison thing. It's hard to imagine that Will Anderson ever questions himself, either on stage or before or after, right? But I'm assuming that you do, because
of course,
everyone fears not being liked.
Yes, but also if I was that confident in real life, I wouldn't have to do that. Do you know what I mean? Like... The reason that I do that, the reason that me is so confident, that's the, you know, the Mr. Hyde me, the, you know, secret identity me that I would love to be. Like,
totally. Absolutely. I guess that's why I was drawn to the stage, just seeking some kind of validation. I don't know. Maybe now, because I get validation, genuine validation from the people that love me and from myself. I don't.
That's an interesting thing, because like it's one of the things that I talk about a lot is that you the reason you start something is not necessarily the reason that you keep doing something.
Right.
And if I were still doing stand-up for validation, the validation is now the least interesting part.
For sure.
It would be for you as well. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Yeah. If you don't find a new reason to like it or a new reason to engage with it, and you are still trying to, you know, do it for the reasons you started doing it, you know, to get free beer and meet girls or whatever. You know, it would be kind of old and pathetic and sad, you know. And so I get that.
Yeah.
My mind has certainly changed in the way that, you know, what I look for through it as well. So I can totally get that. But you obviously are still a performer. And
yes.
So why radio? What did radio do in a way that stand-up didn't? Because you're saying, what if people hate me? Well, if you're on the radio, people can hate you too.
No, it's not really like you've... Somehow it doesn't. Somehow that doesn't hurt.
What, because they're not there?
Well, maybe they're not there in front of you? No, and I actually think largely it's the fact that, I actually do want to go back to live performance. I just don't find stand-up as something that I'm – firstly, you have to go back to doing your flying hours, and I'm too tired. I can't be fucked.
No, I can understand
too much work.
That's why I don't never stop, because I couldn't start again if I did.
Well, it's why I still run every week, because I know if I stop, I'll never get it back. So it's the same same thing for stand-up. But I do want to go back to live performance, but what I want to find is a version of it that actually I find rewarding as a form. And in radio, I think I just found that the medium so rewarding. So I was able to put aside the fear that people might not like me. Plus, radio led me, because of that relentless need for content every day, it led me to one of my other key philosophies in life, is if you want to be happy, just lower your standards, right? Because you know when you have to rock up every day with content, when you start, you're like, oh, that joke's not good enough. Yep. A year later, after a while, you're like, fucking brilliant.
It filled 3 minutes. I was pretty happy with it.
That's the best gear I've brought ever. You know, so, and that's my philosophy in life too. I'm like, you know what? Stop aiming so high. Not to say you don't have goals, but the only difference between you being happy then and being happy now is if you just drop your standard a little, you'll be fine.
You've changed your perspective on what it is.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that everything has to be perfect. There is, I think that is a really, it sounds so counterintuitive to people, but I think it's really insightful, which is that often the only reason you're not happy with something that is that you've set your own standard of what it should be.
Absolutely.
Too high. And if you just knock it down a couple of rungs, you'll be like, oh, actually, I'm nailing this.
I am killing it today. I put a bra on. Everybody should be fucking like applauding me as I'm walking the streets. Look at that chick in her bra. Amazing. Because yesterday I couldn't even do that. So, you know.
It's one of those things in America when you play stand-up clubs, they introduce everybody with their credits. You know, you would have seen this guy on Conan and the Tonight Show and blah, blah, blah. And Australians, we have the complete opposite approach. The one that I like to quote is Peter Hallier, who used to start his show with the voiceover, please turn off your mobile phones and lower your expectations. It's Peter Hallier. But I was like, that's what we like. You know, lower your expectations and then we might, you know, slightly surpass them. And that'd be a pleasant surprise rather than building it up too much. I think that's a really interesting point of view. Are you able to do that outside of work?
Yeah, like, very much.
I don't know why I turned into Luke McGregor then. Work.
Work. Yeah, for sure. Like my house, absolute pigsty. My wardrobe, I almost never put anything away. It's all on the floor. I look like I've gone on the run, my wardrobe. I am happy if my daughter eats vegetables, say, 3 nights a week. Sometimes it's less. I mean, you know, as long as where she's not got scurvy, I'm okay with that.
But that's a good example, right? Like you joke, but I think that that's something that at least, because I don't have kids of my own, obviously, but having observed friends, you often find that, you know, people, like, they come to this realization of sometimes that'll do, whatever will do will do, whatever gets it done, gets it done. That's a perspective you get from having children, because it's very easy to say, I'll feed my kids organic, you know, vegan, blah, 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 blah. And then you're just like, you know what? He ate Dim Sims for 3 years.
Yep.
It's all he could eat, but he's alive and he doesn't have scurvy, so that'll do.
I mean, well, parenting is one of those things where you see people torture themselves. And I think, I mean, is your kid in jail, then you're okay. Yeah. Is your kid, you know, as I say, scurvy, is your kid beating other kids up, then you're okay. Yeah, like there are so many, like is your kid a drug addict at 12? No, right. Then you're okay. Like I having my daughter made a big difference to my perspective on the world, because I was just – also she was in at the children's hospital a bit. She's had some, you know, issues. And you'd get in a lift with families that have kids that are having cancer treatment or you can tell are extremely ill, and you just think, oh, my God, what the fuck am I worried about? Honestly. So this child is addicted to the iPad and she never looks me in the eye unless I hide the iPad. Yeah. You know, that's normal. That's life. How great.
I mean, what you really should be doing is like recording messages for her on your phone and then just sending them straight to the iPad. That's what you need to do. You just need
parent.
To appear in between episodes of whatever she's watching on the iPad.
Yes, yes.
And just give some, like, you know, and by the way, here's some things you need to know.
I should get it. I should make an avatar for myself and just appear. If I was really good at technology, there should be some kind of coding that you could do to do that.
I mean, that's
put
actually
yourself in there.
Do you know what? That's actually like probably a good app. It's probably a good idea for an app if someone was out there, some sort of thing where parents can sort of appear,
yes,
in avatar form on their kid's iPad and sort of give instructions.
Mm. But you know, all the freaking parent militants will say no, because just take the iPad off them. I'm like, oh fuck, okay. I can't be bothered having that fight with her some days.
Do you feel that parenting is competitive? Like, is that something that – it's something that I hear. Again, I don't have kids of my own. But is it
– I think that's bullshit. I think you're only competitive with yourself. Again, lower your standards. Because really, no one fucking cares. They're too busy dealing with their own annoying children. Honestly, no one cares. I largely don't like other people's children.
Right.
Right. There are a few in my life that are like my best friend's kids or my nephews and niece and, you know, those kids I like. But on the whole, your child is annoying to me, so I don't give a shit what you're doing. I'm only worried about my own kid.
Yeah. People are like, oh, Will, you've got dogs. You like dogs. And I said, no.
Yes.
I like our dogs. Yes. And then because that I like our dogs, I'm mildly interested in other dogs.
I'm the same. People go nuts over other people's dogs.
Yeah.
I'm like,
keep it to yourself.
Yeah, because that dog smells like a smelly dog, whereas my dog smells like my dog smells. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure that people walk into my house and go, ooh, doggy smell. And I'm like, I can't smell it.
Yeah.
Because it's my dog.
Exactly.
I can put my face in her tummy and it smells delicious. Are you a cat owner too? You know cats?
Yeah. Well, we've had recent cat tragedies.
Oh,
so we had three cats and one of them moved out of home.
Oh no, because someone else was feeding it, I bet.
What happened was we got the dogs and one of the cats who was a Burmese, Diego, Burmese cats are like dogs and they're very possessive about the time that they get to spend. So Diego was like, nah, fuck this. So moved across the street to our neighbour Pip, who we love and who loves Diego. So he decided that he was like, I'd rather go over there where I get 100% attention than stick around this house. But we were like, well, that's okay. You know what? Your teenagers move out eventually.
Sure.
We're fine with this. He's still across the road. We can visit, you know, that sort of thing. But then we've had in the last year, both of our other cats have died. So it's been a bit of a sad old time. So we've been discussing with the new move about whether we'll get a new cat. But we've got the two dogs as well. So
we're
in that world at the moment.
I'm a cat lover. I love the way cats love.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they love on their terms. You know how dogs, like we have a Labrador and we have a Tonkinese, which is Burmese Siamese cross. And the Labrador makes me sick how desperate she is for love.
Right.
And she will roll over for any
for anyone.
Sad loser walking down the street. If it looks like she's going to get cuddles, she's like, yeah, I love you. I love you. I love you. And I'm like, come on, Scout. Get some dignity.
Yeah.
Like have some pride.
Too easy.
Whereas the cats, they're like, I don't really feel like loving you today. Yeah. Like,
or the other one the cats do really well, which is just that thing of going, you can love me for a bit, but now I'm done.
That's it.
Like the minute you're like, oh, you're really loving this head rub. And then it's like, yep, done now.
That is it.
Got some other stuff to do.
And I think for For a long time, I'm better now, but I'm quite I'm a very independent person. I'm not someone who allows myself to be vulnerable with other people, and certainly in my relationship. For a long time, Daz and I were like married, but not really connected. Because that's sort of how I get the way cats love, that they're just like, yeah, it doesn't mean I don't love you all the time. I just don't need you.
Right.
It's great.
Yeah. And I can love you all the time. I can love you while I'm doing something else.
Totally.
And I can love you actually better sometimes when you're not here. Yeah.
That's it. I love you so much more when you're not here at all.
Yeah. Sometimes the best way to appreciate you is for you to not be here. Because sometimes when you're here, I actually appreciate you less.
Oh, my God, yeah. So much so.
Let me miss you a little.
Yeah, my husband, God bless him, but Jesus, even the sound of him chewing. We have a very long dining table and I sit on the end and he sits on the other end and I have my fingers in my ears because just the sound of him chewing, which I'm told, according to Kelly Osbourne, is a psychological thing. She won't let anyone chew in her presence, but...
It's interesting because there's a new kind of internet trend. Do you know what ASMR? I think that's what it's called. ASMR is. It's people who like, sounds like chewing or like people unwrapping cellophane and stuff like that. Oh yeah, it's a real thing.
Oh, that makes my whole body crawl inside itself. People do that for pleasure.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's it's a big thing. I think it's called ASMR. Have you heard of it, Michael? No. Anyway,
it's like that tickle thing too.
Well, that's interesting to me. Don't like being tickled?
No.
No, me neither.
I like to be touched hard, Will.
And we'll be back after this message from our sponsors.
No, but just like don't be half-assed about it. Like, you know, if you're going to put your hand on me, like...
Put...
Properly, that whole lighthearted thing. I'm like, what are you doing? That's gross.
How do you feel about someone who... Oh, I'm interested in this because we just live in a changing world and for a bunch of really good reasons. We're in a transition at the moment where I feel like... And this is an observation, not a... Because I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, you can't even open a door anymore or whatever, I think we're in an interesting transition in the way that people greet each other. Because what I've noticed is, particularly with women, is there's that we're still kind of in between that thing of going, there'll be some people who naturally go in to kiss a man regardless of whether they know them or not still. And there's And there's like some people are very comfortable with a handshake. Some people hate a handshake still. You know, we are still in that zone where some people have moved very much to, you know, you greet men and women the exact same way. And there's a kind of in between there. When you were in the radio and you were meeting a lot of different people.
Oh, people love a kiss.
That's interesting,
so
isn't it?
So weird, don't you think? If you just met someone, they're coming in for a kiss?
I think so.
It's just like, what are you doing?
But also, I bet I've done it in my life before because sometimes you don't realize how strange something is until it's pointed out how strange it is and then you can never look at it the other way again.
Yes.
Like, I think I was raised in a country, you know, you kissed women, you shook men's hands.
Yeah, regardless. But you wouldn't kiss someone you didn't know.
Well, I think you probably did.
Would you?
Well, I mean, not kiss, but that sort of like...
A kiss on the cheek. I always shake hands, male or female.
Yeah.
If I'm meeting someone for the first time. I really like a good handshake. And you look them in the eye and it's something very kind of respectful and honest about that to me.
Right.
A kiss on the cheek with someone I don't know, I find weird. And I... don't really want to do that. I don't want to kiss someone that you have never met before.
I mean, it seems weird. It's like the more you say it out loud, you're like, it just seems weird.
It's so weird. But even now too, because I've noticed with girlfriends, we all kiss hello, right? Yeah. Which is lovely. But it gets to a point where you might see them three times in one day because you've got school drop-offs, school pick-up, and then you've got like a birthday party in the afternoon. And by the birthday party, I'm still kissing them hello. I'm like, enough kissing. I don't know why I'm kissing you. I just saw you an hour ago. So I've tried to stop that, but then they get a bit odd. They go in for a kiss and I'm like, well, And then I think that makes it awkward as well. But yeah.
With my male friends, I am a hugger. I definitely
love
a hugger
between men. I love seeing men hug.
But I had, so when I started doing the radio show, when the morning of the announce that I was going to do the radio show, so Mick and Eddie and Luke are in the studio and I've sort of come in and they're going to announce that, you know, I'm going to be doing the show next year. So Mick and Luke are both, you know, 20-year friends of mine. Yeah. So I come into the studio, you know, they're like, congratulations. I give Mick a hug and then I give Luke a hug. And then suddenly I'm like, wow, I've really put myself in a situation here.
you can't deny the hug.
We both just had a hug that we both knew neither of us wanted and was never going to happen again.
No.
But it happened.
Well, I mean, and I think that's why.
I just hadn't looked far enough ahead in the consequences of my first two readily offered hugs.
People feel trapped into kissing the person they've never met before because they're with a friend of theirs. So you kiss hello
and then
with
you
your
feel
mate
like, yeah.
And then, oh, this is so-and-so and you're like, oh.
Yeah, it feels like a judgment.
Yeah, but I will go, I'm not going to kiss you. I literally will say, I'm not going to kiss you. I've only just met you.
Joe, we are just going to have a pause.
Oh, okay, good.
I won't mention what you just said.
Ryan,
but
don't do that. No.
You know, I do want to talk about one thing, though, which is that you have had a lot of experience of working with other people, which is something that I'm interested in. You know, when you first started out, you know, you were in a trio when I first saw you.
Yes.
You know, obviously you've worked in a whole bunch of radio partnerships. Mm. You know, you've worked in collaboration with a range of very different people. Mm. What have you learnt about working with other people?
Well, my number one philosophy around that is, and I think you'd agree with me, Will, that this is unusual. I think if I'm focused on making the other person look and sound better, I'll look and sound better. Whereas I think a lot of performers are really only focused on them being the funniest or the wittiest or the quickest or the strongest or the last laugh or the last word or whatever the hell they worry about. And I just don't think long term at least, and possibly short term as well, I just don't think you're going to be as successful and be as funny. I just think you look better if you try to make the other person look better.
The only time that somebody's sitting at home counting the jokes or, you know, like the only time anyone's ever doing that is if something's not working.
Exactly.
If something's working, everyone's great and everyone's hilarious. And if it's not working, then it becomes that idea of going, well, I got my bit away.
Yeah. But don't you reckon there's a lot of people have that attitude?
It's interesting. Like I find it like because I'm very similar to you in that regard, which is, you know, I go into something and I go, well, what are the resources that we have and how can we best use the resources that we have? And if everybody is better, like if I am giving someone the ball in a better position, they will be better and therefore our show will be better and therefore, you know, we all look better.
Yeah.
It's not about, you know, me necessarily coming in and making it about me. But that's an interesting thing to understand or know. Did you think you knew that at the start? Is it something that you've always had intrinsically in you a bit, or is it something that you had to develop, that idea of that by making other people better, you can also make yourself better?
Well, maybe I learnt that in year 10 drama and theatre studies, doing theatre sports. I mean, it's pretty basic stagecraft, isn't it?
I don't know if it is actually. Like, well, so tell me about, I don't really don't think I know much about like your schooling. Where did you grow up?
I grew up northern suburbs of Melbourne.
And what does that mean, northern suburbs?
Well, Yolambie was the suburb, so Lower Plenty, Greensboro way.
Okay.
Went to school a long way from there in Canterbury at a girls' school.
Okay, all girls?
All girls.
So I'm interested in people who go to same-sex schools because I went...
Did you?
No, I went to a co-educational school. Right. And I find it a really interesting thing we do as a society that during our formative years, because here's the thing that I would say is, I think we need to, like, I mean, as human beings, men and women have a whole range of difficulties of understanding each other and working together.
More and more so, it seems.
Right. And I'm not sure that much of that is helped by splitting us off for the most formative parts of our lives. I often think that the attitude that men have towards women often comes from men who didn't stand side by side with women. You build up all these myths or theories about women because you didn't actually, you know, practically go to class with any women. But there might be, you know, positives and upsides as well. I think that single sex schooling, I can't even know what they call it, but like,
I think that
is probably better for women.
Yeah. I think as a philosophy, an educational philosophy, universally, they say single sex schooling is better for girls. Boys should go to co-ed schools.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate for the girls that go to those co-ed schools as some kind of sacrifice to make sure those boys are raised understanding how to engage with women. But
it's kind of, they should do it. And it should be kind of like the Hunger Games. Yeah. Like each, you know, district has to nominate one each year, and you're going to go and live amongst the boys. You're going to have to be at the school.
That's it. Sorry about that. Just for the benefit of the whole of humankind.
Yeah.
So for me, I am a natural introvert, very introverted at that age, and I know that I just would not have done as well in a class with boys. It wasn't a choice. My mum just chose for us to go there anyway. It wasn't like I had a choice, but certainly Daz and I are continually talking about where Willow will go to high school, and I want her to go to a girls' school. And Daz tells me exactly the same argument that you've presented, that that's not society. But I just think girls need assistance, or they need to be in an environment where they are not going to be naturally kowtowing to the energy of boys in the classroom.
Yeah,
you know, honestly, Will, if I was sitting next to you in a classroom, I would not speak up. At that age, there's no way I would have.
No, I understand that. No, I think I think what you said before is absolutely 100% right.
Yeah.
That the boys need the girls, but the girls don't need the boys.
We don't need the boys.
I feel like this Hunger Games tribute idea is actually the one that we're onto.
Unfortunately, though, there has to come a time when you do learn to speak up in a room full of men. And more and more, hopefully, the gender parity will mean that that's not the case. But unfortunately, according to the World Gender Gap report last year, it's going to be 217 years until we reach full parity on this planet. So for my daughter's generation, she needs to know how to speak up in a room full of men. I'm just not sure that when you're learning your maths and your English lit and you're trying to get the best score you can to leave school and get into a good university course, that's the right place for it.
Should we be doing a better job just in general? Because I often think that the inbuilt sexism or misogyny or just like inherent male bias in our systems that has been there for, obviously, you know, for the origin of, you know, the species, and that we're now dealing with finally in a sort of, you know, in a way that it feels like, you know,
people, at least we're aware of it.
Right.
You know, most of it. Yes. Yeah.
I often think that it serves men as badly as it serves women.
100%. This is, you know, I work constantly for gender equality, not just because I want my daughter to have opportunities that perhaps I didn't have, but because I want her male cousin, who's the same age as her, to feel like he can be the person that he is. It's about recognizing the human, not the gender. It's about allowing that child to grow into the person they are, regardless of stereotypes, not actually imposing, well, you're a boy, so you should play sport. Boys don't necessarily need to play sport. They don't want to play sport. Some of them want to be arty. Some of them want to be creative. Some of them want to dance around in lycra, whatever the hell. It's your choice. When you really sort of filter that down, that's why, it has to be why, men don't feel like they can be in touch with your emotions. And that's why we have suicide rates in men. That's why we have relationship problems, because boys aren't allowed to be that kind of person. In the same way, girls aren't allowed to, I don't know, do science and engineering and all those sorts of things.
The example that you used, if we're sitting together in class, I absolutely agree that it probably would have gone the exact way that you thought it would have gone, that I would have been the loudmouth, smart ass.
I'm imagining that's what you were like in
right,
class.
Absolutely,
were you?
That was what I was like. And, you know, the ones who made the teacher cry, you know.
How did you make the teacher cry?
One day I said something. She goes, well, if you think you know so much, you get up here and teach the class. So I did. And
of course she didn't
appreciate that, and she cried. I feel bad now. But the point is, I wish that I'd learned back then. I understand what you're saying, but I wish I'd learned back then about the idea that, because what you don't learn is the idea that you're speaking over women, or that you're not acknowledging women's point of views, or that women will wait if a, like, you know, as in that if I keep talking, that isn't because everyone thinks I'm the most interesting, but it's because the woman next to me, you know, feels like she's been silenced or doesn't have a voice or an opportunity to speak up.
Yeah.
I honestly am still struggle, and I've caught myself doing it a couple of times during this interview, is that remembering just not to naturally talk over someone, or to, you know, reframe their idea as my idea. You know, I've done it a couple of times already, and it's not like I am intentionally doing it anyway, but through 30 years of, you know, you being treated in the same way and expected to behave in the same way, those things are as hard for me to unpack and unpick because there's been years and years and years of people teaching you that was the way that things were without you having that realization. So I guess what I'd rather and would hope for in the future is a time where we're sitting next to each other in class and I go to talk over the top of you and it's pointed out to me how that, what that is that I'm doing, and how it would be better for me to, you know, include other people in that conversation.
I'd love that too.
Yeah.
I mean, you started in kinder.
Right.
I mean, boys and girls sit next to each other in kinder, and you see boys are just much more rambunctious, you know. And again, even having the conversation around gender and the types of people that kids are is already putting us back in that same position. Like we're making it a gendered conversation. But the fact is, when you see children in a childcare facility and they're age two, they're already, their behaviours often fall into the genders. And even from there, you could be having that conversation to a little boy or a little girl. That's sort of what Safe Schools.
Safe Schools.
Yeah, the Safe Schools program, which apparently is teaching boys that they want to cut their penises off. That's what the extreme right is suggesting it's teaching. Yeah. It's not. It's teaching kids to understand that you don't have to fall into those gendered roles, but also, yeah, be aware of each other. It's basic respect. Really, it's basic respect for other people as they speak and as they express their opinions and their who they are. But
so when it comes to work relationships, which is where we started this conversation, you've worked with a range of very different personalities. Mm. How do you change and adapt to working with someone who might be a complete opposite personality or dynamic to, you know, the previous person you worked with, but in a similar role? That's not to, I don't want to get into a world where you have to draw direct comparisons. I'm more interested in the overall philosophy of, you know, working with two different people in the same sort of job and, you know, how you adapt to the different ways that people work and respond and all those sort of things.
Well, I mean, I think I always fall to, and I think this is not because I'm a woman, maybe it is, but I think it's more that I'm a middle child and I just let other people speak first and listen to what they're saying and then I'll make my point. That's kind of how I've always gone. And at Fox, it was kind of a recognised thing and then people would talk around it and then eventually someone would go, or usually Dave Cameron would go, and Joe? And I'd say what I say and everyone would go, yeah, what she said probably is right, yeah. Because I just kind of, you know, I'm not interested in competing for airspace or volume. Ironically, in my family, we're all women and we're extremely loud. So potentially I am in that space. But in a workplace, no. I just would rather hear what other people say. And that way, you tend to get on well with people if they trust that you're going to just let them talk first. Which now, I mean, even I hear myself say that and I kind of don't like that in myself. I wish I was more assertive, I guess. But 10 years on one show probably wouldn't have happened if I was more assertive initially, I guess. And I certainly, my relationship with Matt Tilley was so great because we worked, we understood each other and we listened to each other. And, you know, there was never a point where he walked all over me. I never felt like he got his own way, regardless of what I thought. It was just that we would sort of negotiate that conversation, I guess. I don't know. It's a weird, I've not thought about it a lot.
When you do a job like radio, you spoke earlier about the idea that it's just constantly churning through ideas. You know, it's a voracious beast and you have to fill 3 hours a day, you know, full of content from your life and from the world.
Mm.
It's the life bit that I'm more interested in, because how much of your life do you give to the public versus how much of it do you keep to yourself, and how do you decide which bits are which?
Well, I would ask you the same question, because I've loved the way, Will, how you are so on top of what's happening in the news, and your jokes are very about the content of the day, whereas that's not my natural inclination. I can do it, but it's not. I'm more about anecdotal. This is what happened in my life. I'm sure it's the same as yours, kind of connection with the audience. So how did you navigate that? Do you navigate that?
I lean very hard into the things that I'm comfortable talking about
yes,
my life.
Right.
And then leave everything else alone.
Yeah.
So, you know, I get arrested on a plane, I write a whole fucking show about it, yes, and I tour it everywhere. And so people are like, look at how you look. He bleeds for us. He's open and honest. Yes. But there are whole other aspects of my life that are none of your business, you know.
Yeah.
And so what I tend to do is like keep the my general rule is that I'm pretty much happy to talk about anything where I am the butt of the joke.
Yes.
But if it involves someone else in my world who hasn't chosen to be in that world, they've chosen to be in my world but not in the world of having to have their life talked about on the radio or having to have their life discussed on stage and those sort of things, then those people only become characters in my show if I am the joke is about me, or the thing is about, you know, me doing something wrong, or me, you know, being the punchline of this scenario. So that's kind of my general philosophy to my life and how I, you know, put my life, you know, out to the public.
I think that's a really good, that's always been my philosophy too. And people always say, oh, poor Daz, you know, he cops so much, but actually everything I share of him firstly is true. So that's my ultimate defense. I'm not making it up. He did it. But secondly, it's always through the prism of our discord as couple, and I see myself as much a butt of that story as he is. Like, I feel like I'm telling a story because I am reacting in a fairly extreme way, and therefore I look like a fool as well. But I was on a panel with Danny Katz and Claire Halliday. You know, Danny's been a columnist for how many years? 20-something years?
Forever.
And his writing is all about his life. And Claire Halliday's written some books that are all sort of about her life and others. And we're talking about that exact question of at what point should you draw the line when you're talking about other people? And Claire had interviewed some people who really had exploited others. Well, exploited is a strong word. I'm using that word. She didn't. But, you know, had told stories about other people. And they were very unhappy about it. I said, please don't publish it. And still they went ahead and published it. And I just don't think that's your right. It's not your story to tell someone else's, even if you've got a perspective of it. Like, you know, you've got a father and a son talking about the same instance, and the son's perspective is, oh, it was horrific. And the father's saying, that's not my memory of it. Well, is it your right to tell that story in that way then, that paints him in such a bad light?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, like, I mean, I guess it's varying degrees of things, you know, would depend on what the degree of the hurt is and how much, you know, of it you're allowed to tell yourself. But I certainly know from my point of view, if, you know, my parents are in a story or whatever, it's traditionally they're the heroes of that bit, or that, you know, I'm the punchline of that bit, because, you know, they're dairy farmers from country Victoria, you know, they didn't expect this, you know, they didn't expect any of this. And, you know, every now and again, they'll find me on the, you know, A Current Affair or on the front of the papers, and they have to deal with that embarrassment. So I don't want to have to put them through extra stuff as well.
And when you have a child, like when Willow was a baby, people just expected I'd be like, yeah, sure, get a photo of my kid.
Right.
And I'd always say no, because I'd say, well, she's not old enough to give consent to that. people were amazed. They were like, oh, but it's your baby. I'm like, yeah, I don't own her. She's an entity of her own. Like, she has total ownership of her choices. It's just she can't express them right now. And now she's older. She is on my social media because I ask her, are you okay with this photo? There are plenty of times she'll go, no way, Mum, that's not – take another one.
Yeah. You know. I'm not saying I don't want to be on there. I'm just saying
– yeah, but, yeah. You know, it's crazy to think that just because someone's in your life and you happen to be in the media that they then are consensual to that, to them being in the media.
What has been apparent, and I don't expect there to be one answer to this necessarily, but – yeah, perhaps what has most surprised you about being a parent, I guess, is what I really want to know. What was it about, what is it about being a parent that you've gone, oh, this is a big part of it that I didn't realize was going to be part of it at all? Is there something that falls into that category?
Well, this is going to sound crazy, but I didn't think I would love her as much.
I love that. So,
like,
what do you
so
mean?
So, even when I was pregnant, and I don't know whether that this is because of the kind of person I am or, as I've mentioned earlier, the sort of the way that I have loved or whatever. I don't know. But I just didn't, even when I was pregnant, I didn't kind of connect with the concept of being as in love with that person as I ended up being. And then when we had her, she was very sick, and it was sort of a few days before I really kind of understood even what was going on. And then I just remember this moment, like at maybe she was day 5 or 6, and just being, just I couldn't believe how much I loved her. And every single day that you're a parent, you love that child more. And now, what's crazy, like, I've always thought, when people say, oh, my kid's my best friend, I'm like, oh my God, you sad fucker. But genuinely, she's my best friend. I genuinely couldn't think of a person I would rather be sitting next to. And she and I are so addicted to each other. We're like joined at the hip. And every time I think about the fact that one day I'm going to say goodbye to her in an airport and she's going to backpack around the world, and I honestly, I have been on the couch inconsolably crying at the thought of that.
You know, Samantha Lane, do you know Sam Lane, you know, the journalist?
Yeah.
And she sat where you're sitting a week ago and talked about the fact that her dad is still her best friend.
Oh,
and my brother moved back to the farm and, you know, works – yeah, side by side with my father every day on the farm. And I'm not, I don't know if, you know, they're best friends, but they're like, you know, I mean, they have a very close friendship.
Yes.
That is something other than being.
I mean, he's clearly the favourite son now.
I mean, I think that horse bolted a very long time ago. And the reason that the horse bolted was that I left the gate open because I'm no good at being a farmer. That right. would be, in fact, the fact that we had a horse and I was trying to milk it when we were on a dairy farm was really, there was a whole range of issues.
No idea.
Don't let Will in charge of anything anymore. No, I mean, of our family, even though my parents couldn't ask for better parents.
Mm.
Certainly they have a closer relationship with, yeah, my brother who is back there with his family and working on the farm, and my sister who has 4 kids, and they have a kind of very practical, you know, Mum will, you know, helped a lot with the kids when I was growing up. So they have much more immediate and close relationships with my parents, which I'm like, it's interesting because I admire and love the relationships that they have with Mum and Dad.
Yeah.
But I don't desire those relationships with my mother and father. Like, I love my mum and dad. Like, and honestly, couldn't have asked for better parents. It's one of those things where the only thing I resent about them is, as a comedian, didn't quite give me enough pain to really, you know, win a couple more awards. But just lock me in a cupboard once, Mum. Yeah. You know. but I don't desire the same relationship with them that my brother and sister do. And interestingly enough for me, my parents don't seem to desire that relationship with me.
They're not on the phone to you saying, when are you coming home,
right?
Will?
You know that traditional thing of like, you know, be like, I don't call them enough?
Yeah.
I think I call them about the amount they're happy for me to call. I think we all feel like we've, you know, every second birthday.
You've worked it out. Yeah. Okay. Arm's length. It works for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that your relationship provided you're both, you know, well-adjusted people, parent and child, it is as it's supposed to be. And you, it's very instinctual, I guess, is what I mean, is that you are as you are intended to be. And Willow and I, like she and Daz are really into each other, but Willow and I kind of just, we'll just sit and giggle next to each other. That's the other thing. I didn't expect it to be as fun as it is being a parent. But that's a choice, you know, you could. And I've heard, oh, my God, I've heard mothers at playgrounds whinging about just the smallest things. And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? You're in the sunshine with your child. There's nothing to worry about here. But they're whinging about the fact that the kid, you know, didn't have its freaking breakfast or, you know. Yeah, so your kid spilt milk all over the floor. Who fucking cares? Don't cry over spilt milk. But, like, it really doesn't matter. And for me, and maybe again, it's because I'm so focused on in the moment, and children teach you they are total mindfulness. They don't have a future or past. They don't get it. They don't get time. Time is right now. And so if you can really engage with that, oh, my God, it's the greatest fun you'll ever have.
There's a broader, I mean, if you, and I am not smart enough to know much about quantum physics, but.
Don't talk to me about quantum physics.
Well,
I didn't even do maths or science.
But there's this theory that, like, the way that we experience time is not how time is actually happening. That all time exists at once.
Right.
And we are only experiencing it in a linear fashion.
Right.
But everything is. So this is my link between quantum physics and...
Do you believe in clairvoyance?
Of course not, you crazy, crazy person. But
that's how they're able to connect with people who've passed over, because that's what time is. Yeah.
So speaking to that.
Yeah.
As a teenage girl, you know, the thing that you hear is like, you know, the person that you love the most, and I saw it with my sister and mum who are... I would say still probably best friends as, you know, like adults. Yeah, there's a terrible period. There's a period where you become a teenage girl and your mum, who was your everything, becomes, the bane of your existence. Mm. Do you fear that? Is that something that you...
I do a little bit. But I'm also really prepared for it in as much as I am so certain of my love for her that I don't hear anything with the agenda of, oh, she's hurt me or she's rejected me. Or to me, it's not about, like, you know, if you have a friend who starts being a complete pain in the ass, then you're going to go, well, that's not a good friend to me anymore. But whereas my child, she's always going to be my child. It doesn't change, you know. And I think I don't hear it as a somehow an affront to me, or somehow that it's insulting to me or disrespecting me. I just think, well, that's her doing her thing. Obviously, I set boundaries. I'm not without discipline, you know. I'm the person who kind of keeps the house together. If I'm away, she eats nothing but McDonald's and they watch movies until 11 o'clock at night, and Daz wonders why she's tired and cranky. So I am that person, and there'll probably come a time when I'm going to have to say, babe, don't talk to me like that. Don't use that language. Don't have that tone. All that kind of stuff. And we might have fights. But I kind of feel like my love for her won't change.
At some stage you're going to, and maybe have already, but have a serious chat to her about, and I'm not going to get into sex because it's not that sort of podcast, but about love. You know, who she might choose to love in her life. And luckily we live in a world where, like, the options for who that might be and the way that that might be accepted are a little bit more open as well. But what will you say to her about love and, you know, the role of love and, you know, advice that you might give her about, you know, whether she might want to find someone to share her life with? You know, are those things that you've thought about, you know, what you would say?
See, the great thing about being a parent, the best lessons you teach are just going about your day. I recall my greatest lesson I taught her as a child was, we don't drink water that our bottom's been in, right? Because, and that doesn't sound like something you'd have to ever tell someone, but children like to drink the bath water.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's a rule for life. We don't drink water that our bottom's been in, Will.
Right? I mean, I think that's a pretty good rule.
Yeah.
I mean, some people, I mean, whatever you're into.
Look, like, as an adult, if you make that choice, I'm not around anymore.
Some people probably pay very good money for that.
They might well. And maybe you might fall in love with that person, and you are entitled to love whoever you want to love. And already, just as we're going about our days, we talk a lot about relationships and, you know, like certainly around the same-sex marriage campaign, we spoke a lot about that then. Because it's important, and always whenever I talk about it, when you grow up and you either have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you know, you might choose to do this, or, and kids are really curious about their parents' relationships too, so she'll often ask, you know, when did you meet daddy and when did you fall in love with daddy, and I'm still waiting. No, that's unkind. Sometimes it's not a joke. You shouldn't make a joke. Well, no, I adore Daz. 20 years we've been together, which is impressive.
It is.
So, I don't know, you just sort of talk as you talk, as you're walking to school or whatever, and I just hope that she – my number one thing I want for her is that she's able to recognize when a relationship is unhealthy for her and she is strong enough to leave. And I'm not talking about necessarily abusive relationships, although of course that's really important, but just relationships where you might lose yourself a little bit, or you don't speak up as much as you'd like to, or that person has a bad temper, or that person just doesn't bring out the best in you. You know, one of the things that Daz and I, or I, aim for in our relationship is that we always try to make their life easier. Because I'm there, I want Daz's life to be easier, and I hope that he has the same for me. But if you're with someone who's making your life harder, be strong enough to go, oh, this isn't right for me, and leave. That's all I want for her. And that's not easy. That's not always easy.
That's not easy. And it's interesting to me that sort of inside of like check, how's your relationship? Because how's your relationship, I think has a broader... Yeah, I talk about this a bit, like, you know, in regard to drinking or drugs or those sort of things. Like, just, I'm not saying don't do those things. I'm saying just ask yourself, how's your relationship with it? If your relationship with drinking is like, great, you know, it makes me feel a bit more relaxed and I go out on a Friday night and have a great time with my friends and I'm really happy with my relationship with it, then great, fantastic. But just check in every now and again and make sure you're still having the same relationship.
Yeah.
You know, make sure that the nature of your relationship hasn't changed with that, you know. And I certainly have, you know, had to do that a bit in my own life at different times and go, I'm not sure that I'm doing this for the same reason that I was doing it for when I started.
Exactly. I think that we become so apathetic in engaging with the act of living because life is busy, you're tired, you'd rather just, you know.
And constant.
Yeah, and constant. You'd rather sit on the couch and watch a Netflix series or whatever than actually check in with, am I being present in this relationship? Am I being good for that other person, or is that person being good for me? And that's not to say that relationships should always be happy. I mean, fuck, Daz and I have been together 20 years. We've been in couples counselling at least twice, maybe three times. And, you know, there have been times when it's been really bad and we've stuck with each other because of whatever sort of deep-seated knowledge that we know there's a reason for us to be together. So life is not easy in a relationship. I'm not suggesting it should be a fairy tale, but you also have to know when the struggle is enough now and it's actually not healthy for me.
We need to finish up soon, but yes. I still have some other questions that I want to ask you. So basically, they all kind of come from one question, which is, what do you reckon happens when we die?
Oh, Jesus.
So
you've really left.
I'm not asking you for
looking at my list of things that I brought. I've got bottom water away.
Let's go through. What's the rest of your checklist? Tell me what else was on there.
I've got lower standards. Okay. I have a 90-minute rule for movies.
Oh, hang on. So tell me that one.
Unless the film is really good, at 90 minutes I walk out.
Regardless.
Because
you watched The Sixth Sense and you don't understand what was going on.
No, you're like, I would have stayed for that because that was a good film.
Yeah, no, it's a good
point. But like, I'm talking spoilers. Your wedding crashes kind of film, right? Because I don't think any film should be longer than 90 minutes.
And how long have we got on this podcast, Michael? Woo! 80. All right. We got 10 minutes to cover death before we go.
And I think that all films turn shit at 90 minutes.
Okay.
And I've never once been wrong.
Well,
I sat there going, this is quite good. Like, freaking, was it Daddy's Home 2? wasn't bad. And then it turned so shit at 90 minutes. And I was like, should have left.
Yeah. No, it's a good point that Daddy's Home 2 should have come in 90 minutes.
Exactly. Why? Why? It's because they never know how to finish it. That's why it turns shit. What else have I got? Laundry is foreplay.
Hang on, what? Right?
folding the laundry is foreplay.
Why?
Well, because men say, right? Men say they don't get enough sex. Uh-huh. Okay.
Do they? Or just at your house?
This is what... Well, perhaps it's just in my house. But I think all men think they don't get enough sex in long-term relationships.
Yeah.
And women would say, well, they don't get enough help around the house.
Yeah.
Okay. So my theory is if you, as a guy, did more around the house, I would have to do less and we'd have more time together. And in actual fact, if I saw him folding the laundry, to me that's foreplay. To me that going, okay, now you're making an effort.
I get that.
Now I'm seeing you a little bit more favorably.
I don't disagree with what you said, obviously, but I think that it speaks to something a little bit like what we were talking about before as well, because I think that sort of cliche of that, you know, men always want sex and women don't is as harmful to women in a way as well, because often what you find is that we're so confused about who we're meant to be. If you're a man who isn't like constantly going, you know, this is what you hear in society is that men are always bothering their, and women, you know, once they're in a relationship, don't want to have sex. And I don't think that those things are necessarily true.
I do agree.
Yeah.
I agree with you. And that is a very dangerous stereotype. You're right. For men and women, women feeling, yeah, well, you know, slut shamed because we like sex. Absolutely. That's true. I'm speaking anecdotally, not just from my experience, but all of my friends.
It's like, do some fucking laundry, assholes.
Don't sit on the couch like a slob and think I'm going, oh, he's hot.
Right.
I don't think so. That footballer on the telly, he's hot, but I don't ask him to do my laundry.
No, I can just imagine that he's folding some socks right now.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Death. I wanted to talk to you about death because I think it speaks to everything else, which is, so what do you reckon happens? Do you have a fear of it? Do you think about it? Is it present in your life in any way? I mean, I imagine like... And again, I'm asking the question, but I mean, it was present in your life at a very early point in your life. And have you felt like it's been a constant present in your life, or are you a person who doesn't really think about death in a sort of, you know, looming sort of way? How do you feel? What's your thought?
I think about and fear death every minute of every day.
Okay.
To the point where I... first went to therapy 16, 17 years ago to try and silence that, and years later haven't been able to. And really the mindfulness, I think, is sort of the only thing that has allowed me respite from that. Because that's not normal. But
I don't think it's
I don't think it's abnormal.
Yeah, exactly, right? But I don't think it's also, I mean, the fear of death, particularly linked to people who have anxiety, are often, you know, combined together. That, you know, that one of the things that can come with anxiety is that fear that, you know, that of the ultimate, you know, thing that
and
you could be anxious about.
It's not, I have trouble remembering life before Willow, so it's sort of a bit weird. I don't know if you have a weird memory because of Breakfast Radio, but my memory's completely shot. So things kind of come and go in weird ways for me. And since having Willow, I don't remember what I was like before her so much. But since having her, the fear is more about separation from her and the moment I'll have to say goodbye to her, which I can't engage with right now because I'll be a mess. But It's not normal, but I don't think it's abnormal. And mindfulness really is sort of, I guess I just feel like I just am, I focus on gratitude for this moment and how incredible this gift is. And then whatever happens, again, time unfolds as it needs to. And I trust that it'll be okay.
In a practical sense, how do you do that? Because I'm sure there are people listening to this, and I know that there are people listening to this because I get the emails and the Facebook messages. Often people who listen to this podcast will be going through, you know, some period of, you know, being within their own head or not being able to deal with some sort of anxiety or depression that they are having. And I guess they are looking for insight from other people to what has helped them. I understand the concept of what you're saying, but is there a like a practical, you know, way that you, do you have a practice every day about what you do? Is there something that in a moment you can recognize, oh, I'm being, you know, this is, you know, my anxiety is coming on, or this moment is overwhelming me. There is something practical I can do to address this right now?
Well, the answer is yes and no. No, there is nothing, in as much as when it happens, it happens. And I don't want to give the impression that I'm a deliriously happy person every day. And there are days when I feel just a grief that I can't shake, and I can't get up off the couch, or I'll just sit and look out a window for 3 hours and then go, oh, fuck, what have I been doing for 3 hours? Like, you kind of, and that sort of anxiety and sadness, I liken it to, it's like when the tide comes in and you're not really aware that it's come in, and then you look down and you're like up to your knees in water. It's sort of like that. It just can creep up on you, and then you're like, oh, fuck, I now feel really sad and shit for sometimes weeks. And you just go about what you have to do. I meditate every day, and I hate it. I hate meditating when I'm like that, because I feel like I'm almost being dishonest with myself. But it's called a practice for a reason. You have to practice it. And I exercise, even though I don't want to leave the house. I force myself to eat green vegetables rather than ice cream. I try not to drink every day. You know, all those things. It's fucking hard. But at the end of it, somehow the tide goes out again, and you're dry and you're okay, and the sun shines, and you go, oh, actually, that was that. And I think it's really important. Like, mindfulness is based on a concept of that you recognize what's in you, you recognize the emotion, and you investigate it. You allow yourself to investigate that feeling without any shame or blame or guilt. And you say, oh, that's interesting. And sometimes now, because I've practiced at mindfulness, I can feel it in my body before I know I'm feeling it in my heart. And you go, oh, that shortness of breath, I know what that means. I know it's coming. And then you investigate it and you allow it, and you kind of have to let your feelings feel. I'm so wise. Write that down. You have to let your feelings feel.
You should be writing a book right now. Why aren't you writing?
I am writing a book, but
mindfulness.
It's actually, at this stage, I'm thinking it's a mindfulness guide to being sacked.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. It's evolving. I'm not sure exactly how it will end up. Maybe I should call it Let Your Feelings Feel.
No, call it something snappy. Like, those books need to have, like, you know, the one that Amy's been reading is the, you know, the orange covered one, the one that's got fuck in the title, whatever.
The art of not giving a fuck, right?
Yeah, so you need something like that. So. Yes. You know, like, you call it something like movie shouldn't go more than 90 minutes, you know, and then, like, it's, you know, a guide to, you know, a happier and more spiritual life.
Yeah.
Do you believe that once we die, we are dead, or do you believe that there is some sort of greater force or some sort of reincarnation or some sort of, you know, do you have a thought about that?
I have that Judeo-Christian attitude to heaven, that I believe there's a heaven, I guess. But what that means, what exactly is that now? I don't know. I read this amazing book called Proof of Heaven, I believe it was called. Okay, sure.
And did it prove that there was a heaven?
It was by a neurosurgeon, who died and was dead, brain dead for a long time. And then it's his description of heaven. And then he came back. I never finished the book. Because we got to heaven and it started to get really annoying. So then I knew that he came back because he's written the book, right? So I'm like, well, I know how it ends. So I didn't finish it. Because this is what I'm like. I'm not a finisher. That's another one of my books.
Oh, really?
If you don't like something, quit. Not into it.
That's an interesting one. I like that as well. Oh, look.
But as far as what happens after life, my mum used to say to me, because I asked when I was little, you know, can dad see us? And she told me that she didn't believe that he could, because heaven is the absence of sadness, right? And if he could see that we were sad, he would be sad. So therefore he wouldn't know. He wouldn't know that we are. He wouldn't be watching us. And somehow I thought that was really lovely. But now that I don't ever want to be separated from Willow, I hope I'm fucking hanging around. I want to be here. I'm going to be sitting next to her bed going, "So, babe, who's this bloke? What's happening here?" You know. So that's sort of what I'm hoping, that I just sort of hang around like a bad smell.
Yeah, Amy's obsessed by the idea, because I don't believe in ghosts, and she's obsessed by the idea that when she dies, she's going to haunt me.
Yeah, like right.
She tells me all the
to
time.
Prove you.
She goes, "I'm going to haunt you."
Yeah.
Just to prove this point.
Well, let me tell you, guys, maybe that's why you're so clumsy, right? Because Daz, he cannot eat a spoon of any food without it falling on his top, and he reckons there's a ghost next to him just going like, just knocking the fork out of his hand the whole time. Maybe that's what's happening when you drop shit.
I mean, that's a good excuse.
Just smacking shit out.
I might just start leaning really into it. I was like, it's the ghost, love. It wasn't me. The ghost should pay to get my phone screen repaired.
Yeah.
Hey, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for being part of it. What can we plug? I like to plug something. I'll do a proper intro and stuff up the front later. But yeah. Tell people about what you'd like them to know about.
Well, I have two more kids' books coming out in the Play Like a Girl series. So the Play Like a Girl series are aimed at 8 to 10-year-old readers about an under-11 girls' footy team, and they are super strong, active girls just out there being muddy and messy and crazy like girls should be.
I may be the only comedian in the world who has written a children's book at this stage.
Well, these are that's
young
true.
Adult.
They're young not adult. As big as Peter Hallier's books, but I guess if you join them together, maybe. So there's now six of them. So yeah, you could maybe go and buy them if you want, or I don't know, check out whatever else I might be doing. I don't know. Follow me on Facebook.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Such a delightful conversation. Real conversation. Doesn't happen often.
The end.